the MadTech Podcast, news of the week in ad tech and marketing tech, brought to you by ExchangeWire.
Hello and welcome to this week's episode of the MadTech Podcast. I'm Matt Broughton, Senior Editor at ExchangeWire, and I'm delighted to be joined by our special guest today, Kenneth Sim, who is Digital Marketing Manager at Johnson & Johnson. Hello to you, Kenneth.
Hi, Matt. Hi, Rachel. Hi. Really excited to be here.
Absolutely wonderful to have you. And joining me in ExchangeWire Towers today is Rachel Smith, Co-Founder and Chief Strategy Officer at ExchangeWire.
Hello, Matt. Hello, Kenneth. ExchangeWire Towers. I like that lofty vision. If only people could see the office in person.
It's lofty in terms of its stairs. I think that's the extent of its loftiness.
Lengthy sort of ongoing mild complaint from ExchangeWire employees that they have to climb 4 flights of stairs to get to the office. No lift, no elevator.
Oh, well, it's a tragedy. It's keeping us out of the gym. Kicking off into the first news story of the week, Facebook is restructuring its ad business so that it's no longer run on user data. The privacy-centric techniques they're exploring include on-device learning, which runs an algorithm directly on a user's phone to decide which ads would be most suitable for them and then sends the anonymized results to the cloud for advertisers to review. The development reflects the infrastructural changes that the ad-funded internet economy is undergoing, with a flurry of regulatory efforts to reform the way that companies collect and handle user data. For instance, the EU is currently contemplating banning microtargeted ads under the proposed Digital Services Act, while the US government has indicated an interest in monitoring the surveillance of users by dominant internet platforms. Fellow tech titans Apple and Google have already made changes to their operating systems to meet these anticipated changes, including pop-ups for users to opt out of targeted advertising. Facebook has said that this approach would be too costly to their user revenue growth and previously criticized Apple for employing this tactic, saying it unfairly impacts small businesses. Since then, the Zuckerberg-led firm has been experimenting with some of the privacy techniques Apple is using, such as differential privacy, although that they maintain that they're doing this in an attempt to advocate for a different and better approach to advancing privacy in advertising, while Apple is exerting its control over its app store to benefit its own bottom line, in their words. So interested to get your first opinions on this. Kenneth, let's start with you.
Yeah, I think it's really out-of-the-box thinking, right? Very innovative. It's the first that I've heard from all the other big vendors or media partners, right? Because I think the main issue here is the data collection part, right? As you know, data is the currency of the new future. I mean, the future, sorry. And that's why there's so much pressure from the public and from the government, right? So I think storing the data and also the algorithms at the user level now, I think it's really smart and it's really possible because, as you see, most of the mobile phones are more powerful, they have more storage, and also the connectivity with 5G and the future 6G is already there, right? So I think also in addition to that, like artificial intelligence and machine learning is actually much more matured now, much more powerful. So essentially, actually, for me, I think Facebook is able to mitigate the risks away from, you know, hacks and misuse of data and also collecting maybe too much data, for example, right? So I think that's really, really innovative, and I think it's a game changer for Facebook.
It's really interesting actually hearing you sort of share your views on that, Kenneth. Because I wonder if, you know, that's partly, I suppose, as a brand and an advertiser yourself and your experience of, you know, of dealing with advertising on Facebook, but also perhaps your perspective is influenced, no doubt, by sort of being in the APAC region there. Because the first thing that I thought when I read this was, you know, had a little bit more of a cynical westernized view on it, which was, Facebook have got no choice really but to pursue this, you know, approach. I agree that it's certainly front-footed and comes across as innovative to be saying they're going to be getting ahead of the game and completely revising the way that their advertising platform works and operates. And that is absolutely the right thing to do. But the other part of me thinks, well, You have to, though, because data privacy legislation, which, you know, most of it has originated here in Europe, is going to force your hand and you will have no choice. But I was thinking that from a user point of view, people, no matter what sort of options they come up with, I wonder the extent to which users will feel convinced about Facebook being able to appropriately manage their data. But what you've just said there, Kenneth, makes me believe that there are a lot of people that will have faith in Facebook products because they consider themselves to be well managed, and, you know, or they consider Facebook to, you know, produce well managed and well crafted products. And perhaps there in APAC, people are a lot less suspicious of the way in which their customer and consumer data is used. But my point of view on it was the opposite from a European perspective or a westernized perspective, is that I imagine because people are becoming so much more aware of their data, their, you know, the value of their data and the currency that holds, and the ways in which their data is used by big technology companies, will they be a bit suspicious of any maneuvers that Facebook make with regards to personalized and targeted advertising? I don't know.
So I think for in terms of users, I think it's okay if the value exchange is good. They don't mind sharing the data if they're getting value for it, right? The main issue now is coming from the government and also the regulatory pressures, right? And all these the issues that they have with big tech, right? Collecting too much data. So I think with this new business model, right, where the data is at the user level, I think that would satisfy the short to medium term, because, you know, I think governments would be quite satisfied because the issues in question is not solved. It's very solved.
Yeah. And I guess that's the other thing I thought too, is that the devil is in the detail. I mean, this is early days, right? We still don't know an awful lot of detail associated with what this advertising platform and these advertising products will look like. So you're quite right, Kenneth. I think if they're explicit about what they're doing with user data and their efforts to try to either anonymize that user data or collect less data or collect it and store it in a way that makes that enables users to have greater control over it, for example, at a device level or something like that, then I think that will be really compelling. But I'm kind of waiting with bated breath to see what that will actually look like. Because, you know, ultimately, I also think it was interesting, this article touched upon the fact that, you know, Facebook previously used the overcollection of data and holding on to it for their, you know, in a sort of contained environment as a reason to criticize Apple. And now they're kind of setting about doing something very similar. And I'm therefore always suspicious that actually their main motivation is protecting their advertising revenue, which of course is the only way that they monetize their business. So, you know, to what extent will this really benefit users, and to what extent will actually it just be protecting Facebook's interests and also keeping them out of the hands or out of the sort of, you know, beady eyes of the regulators?
So I think if you look at Apple, you know, closely, I think Facebook and Apple have this love and hate relationship, right? You know, they depend on each other, to be honest. But if you look at Apple closely, you know, their unique selling point and their reason for people who buy Apple products is because of this closed loop ecosystem, right? So when you buy, you know, when you buy an iPhone, probably, you know, you need to use iTunes and stuff like that. So the DNA, the core value of Apple is actually to be centralized, to control the consumer experience within the ecosystem. So they're trying not to be like Google, which is open source, right? Open source, and it's more like a marketplace for everybody to use, right? So I think for Apple, I think what they're trying to say is that, you know, this is our world, and if you want to be in our world, you have to play our game, right, and follow our rules, right? And not just for the benefit of them, of Apple, but also the benefit of the Apple users who love this sort of closed-loop ecosystem. So I guess that's what they're trying to do.
Because it's considered premium as well, right? Like they're able to protect their brand integrity in that really closed environment. But it also strikes me, sorry, Matt, running away with this in all sorts of different directions as usual.
It's wonderful to be on this runaway train.
you say that now. Let's see what the next station has in store. But it also strikes me, though, that they're two such very different companies, right? You know, Apple produces a lot of products and is effectively a software company. Facebook provides a social media platform that is also under constant scrutiny for the type of content that it facilitates, right? And so there's still, you know, we're still, I think, very enmeshed in the debate over to what extent should they be regulated concerning their content, let alone their advertising practices, you know. So I still think the way that Facebook sort of presents itself as a technology company first is just starting to, that feels like a very thin veneer to me these days. I feel as though, yes, you're wanting to, you know, design things from a user point of view and purporting to be a technology company principally, but actually all you're doing is regenerating or moving around consumer, you know, user generated content and making a lot of money from advertising revenue off the back of that. Anyway, yeah. Matt, save us from, you know, save me from my cynicism, cynicism.
I just sort of to add to both of your points, I just think it's really interesting that, you know, the three big tech giants we've been discussing, although they've each seized upon the, you know, privacy movement to kind of make changes to their own platform, they're each going about it in a very different way. And as you touched upon, Kenneth, in terms of Apple, they're doing it around their sort of closed loop ecosystem, trying to, you know, have everything channeled through their store. Whereas Google, they want to have this kind of mirage of openness, but actually want to control the flow of information. So obviously have control over Flock, have control over those protocols. Facebook, I think they're kind of, they're in between a rock and a hard place, because I think they're very much wanting to kind of integrate things more in terms of WhatsApp, become like a kind of super app for the West. But obviously with the kind of anti-competitive scrutiny that they're under, they haven't been able to do that. So I think this kind of approach where they're kind of borrowing bits and pieces from Apple, kind of looking at what Google are doing, I think it's, they're kind of scrabbling at the moment. But yeah, be interested to see how those approaches kind of continue to diverge and converge going forward.
Definitely. I mean, they need to completely review their advertising platform and product. So bring it on.
Be interested to see how that all happens.
Yeah.
Moving into the second news story of the week, Gen Z consumers in APAC feel better equipped and more empowered to force brands to make positive changes than previous generations. That's according to McCann Worlds Group's Truth About Generation Z study, which reports that 89% of the region's younger shoppers consider themselves more capable of driving cultural change compared to the global average of 74%. The study also found that Gen Z consumers worldwide typically place a higher value on empathy and creativity than preceding generations. Creativity is in fact the highest ranking adjective to describe a successful brand among this generation. This is compared to the general public's favorite of trustworthy. While over half of Gen Z respondents said that the greatest benefit of social media is the ability to give a voice to disenfranchised, the figure is higher in the APAC region. Furthermore, 77% of the region's Gen Z respondents said that they believe that they have a responsibility to make a positive contribution to the community in which they live. Interestingly, Gen Z respondents also indicated a greater affinity towards brands that can offer comfort, with 74% globally saying that they prefer brands who reassure them rather than challenge, up from 62% in 2018. This is even more so the case in APAC, according to report. So my first question to you guys is, that any of these findings surprised you? And do you think that Gen Z are better equipped as a generation to force brands to change than preceding generations? Rachel, let's start with you on that one.
I thought this piece just made me think, made me reflect on the optimism of youth, which I think all of us that are a little bit older need to continually work to hold on to. I actually thought it was a really interesting piece of research. In answer to your question, am I surprised by some of the results? I am a little bit, but pleasantly so. Like I said, it's underscored by a lot of optimism and sort of paints this picture of a generation of young people that are quite activists. And I like the idea of that. And then the second thing that you asked, quite possibly, because you look at the mediums by which they are attempting to do that, which is largely through social media platforms. And actually, you know, it's really interesting that you're starting to see a lot of brands wanting to tap into sort of direct feedback from Gen Z as a community on how they need to, you know, structure their products going forward. So we all know that social causes and issues and matters of sustainability and so forth are really important to the younger generation. And I find it really interesting that brands are actually tapping into that. So there's a really interesting company. I'm going to give a shout out here to some previous MadTech podcast guests. There's a really interesting company here in the UK called Imagine Insights, run by Kat Agostino and Jay Richards, who are ad tech luminaries. Well, especially Kat. I mean, Jay, I think, was involved in the advertising industry, less so on the tech side. Anyway, they've built a really interesting business off the back of crowdsourcing a community of Gen Z people and running quantitative and qualitative studies directly with brands. So basically buyers, brands and agencies contact them directly and say, we want to find out what young people think of this product or think of this brand or think of, you know, something associated with advertising and marketing. And the company's growing rapidly and doing really well. And that says to me that they're producing a lot of really important, insightful information that brands and buyers are starting to rely on. So even though we look at that cohort of the population in terms of age range and demographics and assume that they don't have great spending power because they're still quite young and because there's a lot of debate about what type of incomes young people can actually get from their, you know, from jobs and employment at this stage and in these kind of economic times, I still think that their power to influence what brands do is about getting involved in the sort of early stages of how brands are developing their products, because they're going to be, you know, this generation of young people are going to be the purchasers of tomorrow. So I do think that they've got the ability to influence brands, and I think that they're they're confident that they do, which is going to be really powerful for them going forward. The other thing that I thought about this too, sorry, Kenneth, I'll give you a chance to say something in a minute, is that I think they're also the first gen. I think they've got quite a lot of confidence in comparison to previous generations of the same age, because they've grown up in a time where, although there's been a lot of social media exposure and we all talk about the potential negative elements of that, that's also enabled, as was mentioned in this article, a lot of young people, I think, to feel included and empowered where they wouldn't have done before, because, social media platforms sort of democratizes people's voices to a certain extent. Anyone can get involved. And I think they've also grown up in a time where lots of things that weren't openly discussed and challenged and dealt with, say, for example, when I was a teenager, like, say, things like bullying and harassment at school or in, you know, casual workplaces or whatever, even, you know, sort of sexism and discrimination, you know, based on sexuality or race or anything, it was talked about from an educational point of view, but it wasn't really talked about, you know, sort of in wider society so confidently as it is now. And so this is a generation of young people that have grown up in that time, and I think they've got more confidence as a result of that, which is fantastic, because it's that confidence that will help them influence brands and, and many other things.
Yeah, I totally agree, Rachel. As you know, with the social media platforms today, it's not a one-way communication anymore. It's two-way communication. And the consumer are actually the media at the moment, right? So they know the power that they have. So brands have to really change, right? As they say, trust is built in a lifetime, but only seconds to destroy. So one post can destroy your entire brand, right? So,
Yeah. So
I guess that's why brands have to change. Brands have to, build the trend, focus on the trend rather than focus on the need, right? And I think most of the Gen Z consumers, actually, the way they shop is totally different. It's more fear of missing out rather than making rational decisions, right? They are more influencer-driven rather than deep promotions, for example. And when they buy products, they actually share. So it's a sharing economy as well, right? So definitely, Gen Z really expect brands to really have the, I guess, similar or higher standard compared to consumers, Gen Z consumers, brand values, standards and stuff like that.
Mm. And do you think as well, Kenneth, that maybe the, some of the figures that sort of jumped out from an APAC perspective are reflective of the fact that a lot of APAC regions are very, and young people within those regions, particularly in some Southeast Asian countries, are very technology oriented. They're mobile first communities and countries and societies. And actually maybe young people are also quite kind of confident, certainly online and on mobile devices, but also on shopping in those environments. And so do you think maybe that's accounting for some of the extra sort of uplift in some of those figures in the APAC region?
Yeah, definitely. So I guess, most of the, I think the average age in Southeast Asia and APAC is around, not more than 35, right? And this generation actually grew up with technology, grew up with all these platforms and stuff like that. So actually, to be honest, they are a generation that is totally overwhelmed with content, with technology, with platforms, right? So that's why they've seen all, do all already. They've done everything. So that's why creativity it plays a very important role. Values play a very important role to them, right? It's not just enough to sell something based on the functional benefits. It has to be emotional as well.
It's also sort of a pushback to that kind of, fast consumption that those of us of an older generation have grown up with, this idea that you can get things, cheaper and cheaper and cheaper. And actually, it's nice to see a generation of people sort of pushing back against that. And maybe we might, because it sort of goes hand in hand with things like environmental sustainability, thinking about the amount that you consume and do you actually need to be buying, 10 t-shirts from Primark every season. Actually, maybe you just need to reduce the amount that you're consuming altogether. And I think that would be a good thing.
One thing I was quite interested in is that we touched on it earlier, Kenneth, in terms of the finding that creativity is more important than trustworthiness. I had a little bit more of a cynical viewpoint on that and thought that this generation has not necessarily been brought up to trust brands as much as previous generations were. The brand is your friend element, which older generations probably were not so much brought up with, but there were still elements of that going on. Whereas now there's less of an expectation to trust a brand. So that's maybe less important for them. And therefore the creativity and way they're putting across their messaging is perhaps more resonant to them.
Yeah, I actually think Gen Z's are quite the unlucky generation, to be honest. Because as they grow up and as they enter the workforce, they had to go through, the great financial crisis, the climate change issues. They had to deal with political leaders like, Trump and stuff like that. And then finally now COVID, right? So I think they really suffered a lot, and the environment around them really changed and set their mindset and attitude. So I think, as I mentioned, they know that they have the power because they are the media now. So they definitely vote with their money now.
Yeah, that's quite a sobering picture that you paint there, Kenneth. You're quite right. I mean, maybe that would also just make them a generation of very strong adults. They've faced quite a lot of adversity in their younger years, and adversity that those of us, that are my age definitely didn't face in teenage and early 20s. Having said that, I did graduate from university during pretty much the only recession Australia's ever had, which I like to remind my parents and my nieces and nephews of, one of those war stories. But yeah, he's hoping that all of that adversity is actually, there will be a benefit from that down the line.
Yeah, absolutely. And hopefully, they don't become cynics like us and carry on hoping and, keep that drive for change, because that'll be hugely interesting going forward. Moving into our third news story of the week, Southeast Asia has become a key streaming market, with players from across the region and beyond driving the market's value up to $1.8 billion in 2020, according to data provided from Omdia, the global research firm that found that ad-supported video on demand dominated in the region in 2020, accounting for 68% of the market's total revenue. Omdia also forecasts that subscription-based services will see their market share rise from 31% in 2020 to 40% in 2025. Netflix has made some progress in the region by localizing their content through the use of dubbing and subtitles, as well as by introducing their app interface in regional dialects. The global leader has also added mobile-only subscriptions in Malaysia, Indonesia, the Philippines, and Thailand to provide a more affordable option for price-conscious consumers. However, cultural factors such as a lower inclination to pay for online content and disagreements over what subject matter is appropriate for viewers have kept Netflix from snapping up a larger market share. Regional contender Vue, meanwhile, has seen success by partnering with local telco providers to expand into new markets. The streaming platform first launched in Singapore, Malaysia, Indonesia, and the Philippines in 2016, arriving in Thailand for a partnership with local telco AIS in 2017, and then launching in Myanmar in 2018. 69% of the company's online video revenue now comes from subscriptions, a huge leap from just 3% in 2015. However, the firm has seen revenue from advertising decline by over two-thirds over the same period. So my first question to you guys is, how do Ondia's findings compare to others you've come across? Kenneth, let's start with you.
Yeah, see, I totally agree, right? I think the numbers look correct, especially during the pandemic. You know, we see that there's a huge uptick in terms of monthly active users, you know, when the COVID pandemic started around this region. And you can see that, you know, during second and third wave lockdowns as well, the consumption has gone up. And majority, I think, the advertising video on demand, it's generally the bigger share of the pie because, you know, as you know, there's so much economic uncertainty and, you know, consumption index and consumer confidence is actually down. So I think as long as there's a value exchange, people don't mind seeing ads. But then I think in regions like Singapore where the purchasing power is much higher, right? The income is much higher. Then you see such a, you know, bigger share in subscription video on demand, to be honest, you know. So I think in terms of platforms, I think definitely Netflix and Disney, I think those are the big ones that are in this region. Only because, you know, the way their business model is being run, they're not too expensive. And they also have very good, I would say, machine learning kind of algorithms embedded into these platforms. And particularly Disney, right? Because, you know, there is, they don't only have a streaming service, but they also have theme parks, they have toys, merchandising, cinema, hotels. So if they're able to consolidate all of the data and try to bring, you know, original content based on that data, then suddenly you'll see that they will overtake all the other local players in the market. And I think, yeah, then definitely you see just a few consolidated video on demands like Netflix and Disney Plus.
Mm. So is Disney Plus widely available in the region, Kenneth? Yeah, right. Yeah. Yeah.
Yes, mostly in, yeah. Yeah. Either in Singapore, Malaysia, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I found the sort of characterization of the struggles, though, that Netflix had, you know, building a more market share, I suppose, than local players, quite interesting. This notion that they'd put in a lot of, investment into local language content and dubbed, subtitled content, etc., but that actually there was still, you know, a bit of a preference for some of the local players because some of the Netflix content didn't appear to be culturally appropriate, right? Which I thought was really interesting. But then when you started to have a look in a bit more depth at the figures coming out about the growth in subscriptions for Vue and the fact that they're, you know, business model is really focusing on somewhat on unique content. So, you know, Korean based content, which is, you know, hugely popular, frankly, globally, but also across Asia, but really trying to package that up as a premium service and therefore, you know, justifying the subscription price tag and how much that's grown made me think, well, basically that's just the Netflix model, but applied to something more localized. So it did make me wonder, you know, will the next Netflix model sort of, you know, sustain over time and actually will the volume of subscriptions continue to rise for them, albeit like you said, Kenneth, a little bit challenged at the moment because people are being mindful of household budgets and consumer confidence is down at the moment due to COVID restrictions. Because when I first initially read that, I thought, oh, here's another example of a sort of, you know, big US company that's become multinational rolling into a region and expecting to be able to unfold the exact same business model and have similar levels of success. But then when I got into a bit more detail, I thought, well, hang on a minute, Vue's done something similar, albeit capitalizing on this popularity in Korean content. And so actually maybe there is more appetite for SVOD in APAC than we think there is, or certainly in Southeast Asia. Because one of the narratives we often hear is, you know, people don't like to pay for content in Asia, and also it can be expensive and people are mindful of their budgets. So I don't know. What do you think, Kenneth? Do you think that model, the sort of SVOD model, is going to continue to rise above the ad-supported stuff?
I think it will increase because, as the article also mentioned, right, telcos like AIS, they all are participating, you know, and subsidizing the cost as well. You know, because you see, for telcos, right, the way they make money, right, the way they encourage consumption of data is either only a few things, right, either music, video, or gaming, because those are the kinds of activity that actually generate a lot of data consumption, right? It's not chats or not apps, right?
No.
So they incentivize new customers to come onto their platform, onto their network, by subsidizing all these video platforms and gaming platforms and stuff like that. So that's why you see a lot of like local platforms or regional platforms like Vue and BTV and ITV from China. They're all thriving within the OTT space because it's not very expensive after the subsidized by the telcos. But, you know, then there is a challenge, right? The challenge is that certain platforms are exclusive to certain telcos, right? So then that competition happens, right? So despite the economic uncertainty and, you know, lower purchasing power from consumers, I saw a very acute trend that's happening now actually in the region where there are like Facebook groups, you know, new Facebook groups where people can join. They are completely strangers and they can just say that, hey guys, who wants to share a subscription with me, right? We will share the subscription. I need three people to share with me, and then we will share the password and username together like that. So even if the price point is quite high, but people are finding creative ways to try and reduce the cost.
Yeah. And presumably, part of that is happening sort of in a legitimate environment because you can sign up to a certain, you know, level of subscription depending on how many devices or how many, you know, individual people you want to be able to share that subscription. That's really interesting. And also, you know, the point that you raised about the partnerships with telcos in the first instance, the article actually made a big point of noting not just those partnerships with telcos, but also partnerships with local broadcasters and other content providers. So trying to tie up access to content via a sort of overarching streaming service. And the way that you've just described that or characterized that makes me think of sometimes when we look at the US streaming market, particularly from a European perspective, or even quite frankly from an Australian perspective, you know, in my home country, it just seems like the options are so vast. I don't know how you would sort of wade your way through that, and how many subscriptions do you ultimately sign up to? So I wonder if actually popularity of subscription services will continue to grow in Asia, but there might come some subscription fatigue along with it that seems to be mitigated by what you've just suggested, which is people trying to share subscriptions, but maybe that's got a ceiling as well.
Perhaps, but I think in terms of the audiences, in terms of the advertiser side of things, that's going to, like, both, I see room for growth in both advertiser and subscription models.
I agree, Matt.
And it'll be, like you said, Rachel, in terms of the saturation in Western markets, it'll be interesting to see whether that pans out in terms of the APAC and Southeast Asia side of things, or whether it all, you know, there will be ways around that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I still see, you know, all indicators for strong growth in ad-supported revenue. I mean, like we mentioned, the report mentioned that you know, still the majority of the streaming market in APAC is ad-supported. Subscription services will increase, but I still think ad-supported content will always be popular. There's always going to be a place for it.
Absolutely. We'll be interested to see how both those grow going forward. Moving into the second part of the podcast, where we hone in on Johnson & Johnson and e-commerce and what Kenneth is up to in the region. So my first question of this part is, how has e-commerce within Southeast Asia been affected by the coronavirus pandemic, and how is this likely to change in the next 12 to 24 months?
Yeah, so I think in 2020, we really experienced, I think, 10 years worth of e-commerce growth in just 3 months, right? Our e-com penetration in Southeast Asia is about 18% at the moment, compared to, you know, previously, which was about, you know, 5 to 7%. And so in this pandemic, we actually, one third of the shoppers are new. And according to Bain and Google, actually 9 in 10 intend to continue shopping online as well. But we can see also in Southeast Asia, you know, quick commerce has actually increased as well, because people are not willing to spend so much time in hypermarkets or supermarkets for fear of transmission. So what they do, they order groceries to the home. Mm-hmm. So that's why I think in Southeast Asia, we've seen a growth of 20x in 2021. So I think that's quite a big thing in Southeast Asia. And we can see that e-marketplaces like Lazada and Shopee continue to dominate the market because they are building super apps where buyers and sellers can come together. And they also offer different kinds of services like insurance, financing, credit terms, and stuff like that. So as more and more buyers and sellers go onto their platform, they get extremely stronger as well. And also, we also see a lot of new services like gamification and artificial reality, AR filters, and also a lot of personalization and data analytics coming on board as well. So I think in the next 24 years, you'll see even more technology innovations because more and more people are staying on e-commerce platforms, they are continuing to buy online.
Mm-hmm. Is that e-commerce growth consistent across verticals, or is there some verticals within Johnson & Johnson that are seeing much stronger growth than others?
I mean, across the category, across all FMCG categories and brands, I think from the latest report, if not mistaken, everybody's growing double digit. If you look at P&G and Unilever, they're all growing double digit. For J&J, we are also growing 2x, you know, 200% compared to last year. E-commerce contribution to our business is around 10 to 12% already, compared to the last few years where it was below 5%. Mm. So we're definitely double up. And in terms of the category, we are really winning in baby care, skincare, and essential health. Because, you know, as people shop more online, they're also looking for more personal care products. They're looking for healthcare brands, you know, that really present value for money, for example, right? So I think across all categories are doing well, but specifically personal care brands are doing much better.
I think there's something a bit sort of, people are sort of in a slightly more experimental mindset when they've really gotten comfortable with online shopping as well. So they start to do product browsing in a way that they maybe didn't necessarily when they went to the supermarket to purchase those products, because they would just sort of go to the same aisle every time and collect whatever they normally would. And you'd be dealing with the kind of, you know, harassing elements of being in the supermarket. Maybe it's crowded or whatever, and you just want to get out of there. So that's interesting. I think a couple of products will have seen an uplift from that, you know, more. And also, you know, in that e-com environment as well, you might be more inclined to sift through reviews if you're looking at, you know, changing products or selecting new products. So it does create a different mindset. Not to distract too much from where you're about to go next, but the quick commerce thing I find really interesting as well, because that's a trend that is only really just picking up, I would say, or that I've become really aware of, here in Europe, specifically in London, this idea that you can just actually get, you know, sort of like a basket load worth of shopping to your door really quickly. You know, online supermarket shopping has been popular in the UK for a long time. But this idea that, you know, there's quite a few services popping up now, Getir, I can't remember what the other ones are. They've all got kind of slightly quirky Zap, Wheezy, that's right. Yep, all my colleagues are piling in here.
You've got things like Uber have, you know, launched grocery deliveries within their platform as well, yeah. haven't they?
Yeah, but those things have become so much more popular, as a result of, I'm sure, as a result of the pandemic and people just getting more familiar and comfortable with that. But that I know that quick commerce piece has been, a real area of growth, especially in Southeast Asian countries for quite a long time, right? So it's interesting the trends catching on.
Yeah, I think that's definitely the future of e-commerce. And just in addition to that, right, I think the secret sauce of all these platforms, it's the AI and the machine learning aspect of it, right? So it actually allows the platform to do predictive and prescriptive kind of models, right? So predictive meaning that if you usually buy Listerine, for example, every 2 months, right, you always buy Listerine every 2 months. So then what the platform will do is they'll probably stock up Listerine within the warehouse that's closest to your home, just in time before you are actually going to order it, right? So that's predictive. They know you're going to order, they're going to stock it up. So when they do delivery, the delivery is very fast. Mm-hmm. You don't have to do very long time. And prescriptive models is more like, for example, if you had to cut certain shoes, like a totally white shoe, right? But then the platform knows that you've been buying black socks for the past 6 months. So definitely you need white socks with white shoes, right? So as you add to cart the white shoe, they will add to cart the white socks as well together. So that it says, this is recommended based on your selection. Would you like white socks with your white shoe? And that is prescriptive for the user. So I think that is the future. And that is the actual secret sauce of all these platforms.
I mean, that has got an interesting knock-on impact to supply chains, right, as well, and organising your supply chains, the whole idea of making sure you've got stuff in stock, knowing someone's just about to order it. We could certainly do with a bit of supply chain tidying up over here in Europe. No one knows whether it's COVID or Brexit. I reckon it's both, but there's been empty supermarket shelves and all sorts of supply chain nonsense going on. So the idea that that suppliers could kind of organise themselves that way, I think is pretty exciting.
Absolutely. One question I had for you, Kenneth, is how, obviously we touched upon how tech can be used to bolster the e-commerce experience there, but how can creative be used to kind of fuel that growth as well?
So I think for creative, there's a few, things, a point or pillars within the creative that's really important, right? So the hook, the pain points that the consumer's facing, and the solutions that the brand's actually trying to solve those pain points. You got to have strong claims, right? And also social proof, right? Because, it's on social and everything. So people need to know whether people are using it or stuff like that. But I think the real important pillar would be personalized creative at scale, personalized marketing at scale, right? It's not just being descriptive of the product that you're interested, not just the retargeting part of it. But it also has to be, as I mentioned just now, predictive and prescriptive as well. So if you can personalize solutions or products or services for individuals on a one-to-one basis, then that makes the shopping experience more rewarding for the consumer, right? And I feel like in terms of creative, I think consumers are also quite spoiled at the moment. They expect, shoppertainment or edutainment when they come to all these marketplaces, right? They expect, live streaming with KCPs or with a celebrity or probably a skin guru, for example. And they expect to be able to converse with these people. They would like to ask a lot of questions. They would ask things like, how do I use it and stuff like that, right? So they're really looking for guidance so that they can have a strong confidence in buying the product. So that's why you see a lot of conversational commerce shooting up in this region, live streaming, and also gamifications, right? Sometimes they allow people to play games, then they would win coupons, discount coupons, they would win free gifts and stuff like that. So I think more social interactions in terms of the creative part would definitely lead to, I think that would be the future for e-commerce here.
And from your experience, Kenneth, are you noticing that that sort of conversation, you know, at sort of, I don't know, agency level about how can we create the most compelling, or how can we produce the most compelling creatives to try to produce, you know, personalized advertising at scale? Is that conversation becoming a little more, you know, commonplace?
Yeah, we're always striving to that, right? That's basically our goal when it comes to marketing, digital marketing. So we do talk to a few platforms, and we're also discussing with the e-marketplaces. But to be honest, actually, innovation really has to be driven by the e-marketplaces here, like Lazada and Shopee. Mm-hmm. So they are the ones that are actually innovating and adding all these new services into their super app.
Yeah.
For us as brands, we only focus on basically the return of investment and the level of investment for each media. But basically, the platforms have to drive the innovation.
Yeah. But to a certain extent, do you feel at brands that you can sort of help push that innovation? Because, you know, do you get into conversations sometimes with the platform saying, this is, you know, from a brand perspective, we'd really like to see this. We're a bit excited about the possibilities. Or does it really, you know... Does it come the other way around? Is it that those platforms come up with some innovative solutions and then, you know, from a brand point of view, you think, oh, yeah, that would work really well for us?
Yeah. So we always constantly challenge them. That's the word we use. We challenge them to perform better because, you know, there are a few marketplaces. And so they try to win our favor so that we spend more with them and we sell more products with them, right? So there's always a sort of a indirect competition there ongoing. But we do challenge them. We do give them, you know, news from overseas and say that, hey, these guys are doing this, China is doing this. Yeah, social commerce is, you know, live streaming is so popular in China, you know, it's a $360 billion kind of, you know, contribution to e-commerce and stuff like that. So they do take note. And I think the e-platforms here do also take inspiration from the Western countries and China as well.
Awesome. Well, that just about takes us out of time, I'm afraid. Kenneth, thank you ever so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Been a pleasure. Rachel, thanks ever so much for joining me in our lofty heights.
Not at all. It's been a pleasure to spend the morning chatting with you guys from Exchange White Towers.
Thank you all ever so much for listening. That's this week's MadTech Podcast.
For all our regular listeners, the MadTech Podcast will take a break while the ExchangeWide team enjoy a well-earned rest during our company-wide summer closure period. Don't worry, we'll only be gone a week, so make sure you tune back in on Friday, September the 3rd.